Every good thing in this world that was denied to me and them because of some arbitrary bullshit ideology that we had no say in was inherently ours to claim. And I said that shit too. I said it loudly, sweetly, and abrasively. I was insistent, maybe even dogged, but I didn't care. I was giddy. This shit felt good, and I felt more free than I ever had in my life. I didn't owe the world prettiness or femininity, softness or strength, desirability or thinness, timidness or boldness, children or chastity. The only one I owed anything was myself. I owed my children a happy and whole human to raise them. That would be my legacy for them. That would be their inheritance. I would start an endowment of radical joy and worthiness. Through a newfound grounding in West African spirituality like Ifa from the Yoruba, family and individual therapy, the exploration of radical Black feminist and womanist ideology, and an online and offline community of like-minded Black women and femmes, I labored and rebirthed myself. I kept my foot on the necks of those in DHS, making sure they gave me what I needed. I was able to start to amass resources, including a contact on the mayor's domestic violence task force to hold folks accountable. I was out of the domestic violence shelter in 4 months. I found a bigger apartment with room enough for all my babies, including a giant master bedroom that I filled with artwork of dark-skinned Black women and plants and pretty antique furniture and a big comfy bed. I embraced joy as my birthright. Radical Black joy is inherent as a human need and not some special trinket you get after you rise high enough on the socioeconomic ladder or unlock some special level of desirability or accomplishment. I decided I would claim and manifest every fucking thing someone told me I couldn't do. My birth mama, these raggedy-ass niggas who use my body as practice, my baby daddies, the friends who kept me around to feel better about themselves, and the overall society that inundates us from birth with the message that certain folks are more deserving and valuable based on their bodies, complexion, race, gender expression, physical and mental capabilities, educational levels, and whatever other fuck shit is just arbitrarily made up and pushed into our minds and down our throats. Claiming and manifesting these things goes beyond just saying them. Rejecting shame is a messy and nasty affair. Dirty business. It requires some serious shadow work to unhinge yourself from the manifestation of hundreds of years of foolishness that shows up in every facet of your life. You commit yourself to being uncomfortable. I committed myself to being uncomfortable. You commit yourself to some of the worst emotional pain you have ever felt. I committed myself to that pain. You want to literally crawl out of your skin. It is not linear or exponential. And sometimes you realize that shame, hiding, shrinking, suffering is infinitely easier in the short term than the arduous and intentional work of getting spiritually and emotionally free. But you curate an abundant community that reminds you of what is on the other side, that loves on you, that pours into you, that holds you and sometimes shakes the shit out of you. You stay in therapy. You say the affirmations. You embrace it all because it's in the fire that you will be forged. It is there you will find peace and joy and liberation. It is in the fire that you destroy shame. I have learned to let go of the things that do not serve me. Shame does not serve me. Claiming what I have decided is mine does. In the last 2 years, I have increased my overall health. I have hired 6 dope humans and tripled the budget of the Black Feminist Project, the organization that I have been working on tirelessly for the past 10 years of my life. I give money to Black women and femmes, especially mothers, to do what they need to do with little to no scrutiny. I have made Mama Tanya's Kitchen, a lifestyle brand for bougetto Black women, a thing. One that includes being hired to do short video content for one of my fave online brands, BuzzFeed's Tasty. I get hired to speak all over the country and sometimes internationally. I am actively working toward my goal of being a media personality. I have turned my home in one of the roughest parts of the city into a place of respite, joy, and productivity. My children are beautiful and precocious. They are funny, they are happy and inquisitive. They are bold and defiant. They are having a childhood experience. We are stronger, and by sheer luck, I have found love. Maybe forever love. It doesn't need to be, though, because for right now, it is genuine. It is healthy. It is safe. It is happy. It is black as fuck. It is intentional, and it is passionate. My baby daddy, my most recent ex and abuser, was murdered a little while back. It was a punch to the gut when I found out. However, what was clear to me was that Tanya from 2 years ago would have been ashamed to lose a partner to gun and gang violence. It would have been one more indication that somehow I had made poor decisions in my life. My children's father was a statistic, a gangbanger, killed on New York City's mean streets. But in fact, he was a full human being who at some point had hopes and dreams, who held deep trauma and pain. What could Wesley have been if he wasn't stuck in the muck and mire of shame, surrounded by a community of folks suffering from the manifestations of the same affliction? There was no shame, no embarrassment, just the complicated feelings of grief, sadness, and regrettable relief. My story has become one of redemption, but also of righteous indignation. I am indignant at the systems deeply rooted in anti-blackness, capitalism, and oppression of anything seen as the other of whiteness that breed debilitating and invisible shame in women like me, in girls like the one I used to be. I am adamant and enthusiastic in my call to tear this shit down, to rip the fucking head off the beast that would stop my children from living fully actualized, free, and happy lives of abundance. I don't want joy to be radical for Black women, femmes, and girls. I want it to be normal, to be expected, to be inherent. I want us to fully be.
Tanya Denise Fields, also lovingly known as Mama Tanya, is the founder and executive director of the Black Feminist Project, the creator and host of Mama Tanya's Kitchen, and the fierce mama bear to 6 imaginative and precocious children. She lives in the Bronx, New York, with dreams of moving south. My head is a part of my body, and other notes on crazy. Written by Kiese Makeba Lehman. Read by J.D. Jackson. I do not want to be killed by a white doctor in America. I think I will be killed by a white doctor in America. That's crazy, right? As a child, the word crazy bounced around every Black space I called home. Crazy was a destination and origin, pejorative and wholly emblematic of our abundance. I love the word crazy. I used it a lot in my oral communication with folks I loved and folks I despised. When we said crazy in my Mississippi village, it had either 1.5 syllables or 3.0 syllables. There was no way to actually spell the 1.5 syllable version. It wasn't at all cray. It was more like crazy. If the hyphen was extremely faint and truncated and the long A was sliced in half, where it almost looked like a 6C barely sticking out its tongue. That's crazy. The 3.0 version, reserved for extremely crazy shit, was crazy. Like when Grandmama and her husband, Hollister Myers, both went into diabetic comas after Christmas dinner, and white people, these young EMTs from Forest, Mississippi, first stepped foot in my grandmother's house. The craziest part of it was how all of Grandmama's children and grandchildren, all laced with graduate degrees, started over-enunciating words when those working-class young white folks came in the house. We assumed that those white folks, the first to ever step foot in that house, had the power to save or kill my grandmother and her husband. They were both extremely vulnerable. In our history with white folks in hospitals, let us know these white folks could eat our elders and their vulnerabilities if they wanted to, without consequence. We hoped, not thought, our proper English would save them. That's crazy. I want to use the word crazy in more of my writing. Instead, I use the language of health, healing, mental illness, and reckoning. Rarely do I admit that I am indeed horrified of hospitals and terrified of white doctors. Some of this has to do with the fact that I've always been treated like a poor big black man, even when I was a poor young black boy, by white people. I've never had a tender medical experience in my life. Instead of going to doctors who I assume will treat me like a nigger, I've avoided them until the blood in my body hissed. While we black men must embrace tenderness and critically engage with our vulnerability, I also think it's crazy how often that vulnerability is gobbled up along with the rest of our bodies by the worst of white folks. That's crazy. I've spent every day of my middle-aged life avoiding light, working and eating in bed, never eating in front of people, not answering the phone when family calls, not answering the door when friends come by, abstaining from that which brings me joy, expecting to die tomorrow, and hiding from people I know when I go out in public. This sounds crazy to me. When I was around people at the strangest times, I'd get this fuzzy feeling in my head and heart, as if I were about to stop breathing. When a friend found me balled up on a wooden bench at work, they took me directly to the emergency room. The emergency room was packed, and I convinced my friend that I would call a doctor and make an appointment as soon as possible if they would let me go home and just lie down. 3 weeks later, when I had another experience of nearly passing out in my classroom, I went to the doctor. I used one of those strange James Baldwin, Nina Simone accents. I tucked my shirt in. I didn't wear sneakers. The doctor, a happy-go-lucky white man in his late 30s, checked my vitals. He checked my blood. He checked my heart. Initially, he said they needed to send me to the emergency room because something on the tests didn't look right. He ran the tests again. "Oh, it's fine," he said. "We just need to schedule an appointment with a cardiologist to see why you keep feeling like you're going to faint." I thought that was a win. That's crazy. I went to the cardiologist the next day. I greeted him as only Baldwin or Simone could. I wore the closest thing I had to penny loafers. I ironed my outfit for the first time in a decade. The doctor strapped a monitor to my chest to track my heart rate for the next week. At the end of the week, the doctor said there was a slight murmur, but everything with my heart was fine. The following day, I kept feeling as though I was going to die. I kept avoiding people, kept swimming in the shame of professional, romantic, economic, and health failure. I Googled heart attack, heart disease, and chronic anxiety. It took 2 minutes on Google for me to understand that I'd been having panic attacks. I couldn't understand why the doctors looked at my tucked-in shirts, heard my fake accent, and still refused to do anything other than treat me like a nigger. That's crazy. My problem, I guess, is that I don't think being crazy should stop us from being compassionate and actively regretful about structural or interpersonal harm we've caused. My friends who have been diagnosed as doctor crazy say it's black crazy to think like this. I say that I don't think we've really considered whose doctor crazy shields them from consequence and whose black crazy is fuel for disciplining and humiliation. The only time I've been encouraged by a white doctor to tend to my mental health was when a white institution thought I was crazy for not wanting a school where I paid tuition to treat me like a nigger. That's crazy. When I was kicked out of Millsaps College 25 years ago for taking a book from the library without checking it out, I was absolutely crazy. The actions of the administration at my school and two of the fraternities were crazy-making. They, with help from all the whitenesses in that place, drove me crazy, or at least crazier. I asked those people, in my art and in bodily confrontations, to stop being so crazy-making. There is little in this world that is more revealing than asking grown white men to stop harming you and your people. Every time we ask or even demand that white folks stop harming us, we are saying with all the vulnerability in the world, you are hurting us like you've hurt my mama, my grandmama, my great-grandmama. And we'd really like you to stop. That's crazy, they always say, in 100 different ways. That's crazy. Of all the terrifying things that happened the day I got kicked out of college, the most brutal was that I was told by the administration that I had a problem with white people, and that only a doctor sanctioned by the same administration who kicked me out of school could let me back in after a year. Vulnerably asking and eventually telling those white folks to please stop treating us like niggers was enough for me to get labeled as not just a threat, but a crazy black boy whose mind needed tending to if I was to ever come back to school. I so wanted to come back to that college after a year. That's crazy. But I was not going to let a white doctor paid by Millsaps College tell me that my desire to not be treated like a nigger in my city at a school I paid to attend was crazy. That decision is still the most self-loving decision I have ever made. And that's crazy. It wasn't until I talked with Dr. Imani Walker about a project that had nothing to do with my crazy that I understood some of what was happening to my body, my head, and my relationship with crazy in college and today. Dr. Imani did more than give me the language of depression and anxiety and chronic fatigue and disordered eating. She told me that everything I thought was wrong with me was everything the nation engineered to ail black folk in this country. My first question to Dr. Imani was, what's crazy? After my conversation with Dr. Imani, like a lot of my friends who regularly go to therapy, I started talking that therapy talk. I beat myself up for not believing my experience with black doctors could be any different from my experience with white doctors. I used words like sourcing and sublimate in conversations that had little to do with misdirected sourcing or sublimation. That lasted a week. That's crazy. Part of my crazy compels me to imagine and really obsess over the radical possibilities of art. In the last few weeks of summer, though, that radical imagining necessitated commemorating radical realities I've yet to accept. I am a writer. I am a black man. I am crazy. Actually, I am the child of two equally crazy kids from rural Mississippi. My crazy-ass mama lives alone on the East Coast. My crazy-ass father lives alone on the West Coast. My crazy-ass lives alone in Mississippi. That's crazy. I have never seen my parents share a loving touch with each other or any partner, yet I know as young folks from rural Mississippi, they lovingly collaborated on my name. Kiese was my father's best friend in the Congo, which is where he was when I was born. My father says his friend Kiese was crazy as hell. Mama was unconscious for 30 hours after they cut her belly open and pulled me out feet first. When Mama regained consciousness, she found that my father sent the names Kiese and Sitoyen over to Grandmama, who was with Mama every minute of labor. Mama really wanted my middle name to be Makeba, after the South African singer Miriam Makeba. Now, a radical name does not a radical friendship make. But my name is Kiese Makeba Layman because at some point, no matter how short-lived, My crazy-ass mama and my crazy-ass father were invested enough in a crazy-ass radical friendship to collaborate on a name their child would spend a lifetime revising his crazy self into. That's crazy. A few months before the beginning of the pandemic, I finally went to the hip doctor. I was terrified. They took some x-rays of my hips first. As soon as I went into the doctor's room, I saw all these pictures of young black men with big bodies like mine on the wall. The pictures were all of football players. The doctor seeing me was the doctor tasked with taking care of the football team in the area. When the doctor came in, I used that fake Baldwin Simone accent while saying how incredible I thought it was that he did so much work for the football team. As I was talking, his nurse came in with the x-rays. The doctor looked at them, then whispered something to the nurse.
"How is it looking over there?" I asked, as proper as I could.
The doctor said that on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the worst, my right hip was a 9. The left was a 10. I immediately slumped. Then I got invigorated because I knew I wasn't being weak when I complained about the pain. This was proof that my body was as fucked up as I thought it was. The doctor told me that if I chose to get a hip replacement, he'd be the one to do it. I told him again that my hips had been making life hard for nearly 10 years. He explained how difficult the procedures are and suggested I might want to wait on surgery because I was so young. He asked me if I'd thought about getting shots in both hips that would make the pain go away for 3 months at a time. "No," I told him. "I'd never heard of those shots." I knew this doctor did not want to perform surgery. I initially told myself it was because I was so fat. I wasn't going to let this man dissuade me from taking care of my body.
"May we schedule the surgery, sir?"
That's crazy.
"If we do the surgery," he said, looking away from me, "the only thing is, I'm gonna have to do it."
That's crazy. The doctor eventually shared something that let me know his right-wing leaning and gave me a script for Celebrex. I made the appointment for the shots in my hips. I got the Celebrex. I eventually went to the hospital in town and got shots in my hips. My pain went away for 3 weeks. When the pain really set back in, I was afraid to ask the doctor to refill my prescription. I didn't want him to help me. I didn't want him to hurt me. That's crazy. Over this pandemic, I've been doing something called Ode and Apology. I started writing odes and apologies to folks I've disrespected and harmed. That was tough, brutal. But it was nowhere near as hard as writing odes and apologies to body parts I've mangled through neglect. So far, I've written to both hips, my eyelashes, the folds in my neck, my wrists, the right side of my groin, my molars, the mole on my left ass cheek, the base of my penis, and the backs of both thighs. The hardest ode and apology was written to my head, my brain, because I seldom think of my head or my brain as part of my body. My head, too big to naturally come out of my mama, has helped me fly underneath the dirt of Mississippi. It's helped me float when my heart has been waterlogged. When my head has begged for help, I thought I was giving it help in the form of rigorous routines of writing and reading. Our relationship is asymmetrical. My head bails me out. I punish it for bailing me out. It punishes me for punishing it, and I tell it to shut the fuck up because we're trying to work. I actually don't know if I am Dr. Crazy, but I know my head needs help. My head needed help when I was in college. My head needs help now. I know that any love I purport to have for any human in this world is not nearly as radical or tender as it can be, as long as I fail to give my head help. It's crazy what this nation does to our heads. It's crazier that many of us who have the means still think our heads are undeserving of help. I know our heads are worth risking humiliation so we can breathe. I know that continual humiliation in this nation leads to death. I do not want to be killed by a white doctor in America. I think I will be killed by a white doctor in America. That's crazy. If I write it one more time, I might actually believe it. That's crazy, right?
Kiese Makeba Layman is a Black Southern writer from Jackson, Mississippi. Layman is the author of the novel Long Division, the essay collection How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America, and the New York Times bestselling Heavy, an American Memoir.
The Wisdom of Process, written and read by Prentice Hemphill. Blackbird singing in the dead of night, take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. The Beatles. I am a Black Southerner, Texas-born with Louisiana roots. I come from people who have survived some of the worst and don't make a practice of looking back. We have moved through always with our culture, with our joy, and we were taught that you move through because you have to. It's what we've always done, sometimes even to the neglect of our healing. Trauma, then, was also not what we call the things that happened between us, when the pressure and powerlessness exploded into intimate violence. Those were secrets and things we endured. We found hiding places in our bodies for all these memories because no one I knew had the time or resources to heal. On Sundays, we took those places to church and prayed that we could be delivered from them somehow without naming them or feeling them or looking them squarely in the face. They were too big or too many or too close. I grew up in a household that could as easily erupt in laughter and hugs and teasing as it could in violence. It's not easy to say this even now. I know that my parents tried to love with the limited examples and the lingering trauma that they each had. As a child, you never knew which way the wind would blow, though. You knew that jobs were lost or never looked for, or that lights were turned off, or that checks bounced. But you never knew when those experiences, combined with a lifetime of pain, would come for you over a small thing. Growing up, we were told that our business had to stay in the family home. In Black families, this is not only a matter of decorum, it is a rule about safety. Safety that is contingent on you being less yourself, and therefore it is also about shame. It is necessary for your safety that you know what this world finds dangerous about you. Brené Brown has defined shame as the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we are flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging. It is the fear that something we've done or failed to do makes us unworthy of connection. This is the emotional weight that many of us carry. Shame is also the way that oppression becomes internalized. It is an emotional ritual for the marginalized. It is a practice necessary to maintain our already conditional belonging here. We feel shame about the aspects of ourselves that are most fundamental to who we are, that are tied not only to our actions, but to our essence. Our Blackness, our genders, our queerness, and all the things that accompany them. Our skin tones, our shapes, our hair textures, our cadences, our desires. And we feel shame about the secrets we hold, many that we hold to keep us together. For me, this meant that one of my first lessons was how to keep people a distance away. In some ways, this was easy. My family decided to send me out of my community to a school that was predominantly white across town. It was one of the most profound shapings for me around shame as a requirement of belonging. It was a lesson in pretending. Pretending that I knew the New Kids on the Block songs they sang when I listened to New Edition. pretending that I lived near them and shopped at the same stores, pretending that the comments and the names didn't hurt when they did, pretending that my home was a steady place. Growing up, I only ever invited one friend over to spend the night. She was one of the four other Black children in my fifth grade class, but unlike me, her family had enough money to live where white people did. Their lawn was always mowed, and their house did not have roaches. The Saturday she was supposed to come over, I spent the morning killing every roach I could find, thinking it was possible to kill enough to be accepted. When she arrived, I planned to walk into every room loudly, offering any surviving roaches the time to scatter. When she came, I showed her around the house, doing my best impersonation of a real kid who was not ashamed or afraid. As soon as I turned the light on in my room, a roach, on cue, casually flew across the room. It sank me. I launched into a story about the differences between water bugs and cockroaches before letting shame and silence swallow me. She never said anything about it then or later, but I remember lying awake that night with tears, biting my lip to stay quiet. This is why you don't let people over. This is why you don't let them in. When I got to be a teenager, my sexuality and gender expression refused to iron out into something more respectable. The tomboyishness that my grandmother identified in me only matured into a queerness that refused binaries and easy categorization. My sense of belonging became even more unstable. For months, I prayed at night that I would wake up changed, interested in different things, with different desires. When I kept waking up as myself, I started praying that I wouldn't wake up at all. When my family finally found out I was queer, it was devastating. It wasn't that they hadn't suspected. It was that, in being told, they felt that I had chosen my identity over them. I had forced them to carry shame for my unruliness. And in their rejection of me, I could sense all the things about themselves they believed had to be hidden or compromised in order to belong, and the expectation that I could or would do the same. To insist that belonging shape around me and receive me as I am was a paradigm shift that seemed too dangerous for a world where all of our belonging was tenuous. So, for a period, I was expelled. I left home, moved across the country, where there was less contact and what felt like less love. I took with me a mountain of shame that would sometimes become defiance, but was always, at its root, a longing to return. As an adult, the shame I experienced around the traumas of poverty and abuse made it almost impossible to allow and maintain intimacy. Always lurking was the fear that I would be found out, that if I invited someone over and turned the lights on, something would fly out, namely who I really was. I hadn't, though I longed to, experienced the sense that I could belong as I am, with my story and with my experience. It's important to name that this task of healing sits against a political backdrop. And that backdrop doesn't allow us to simply individualize healing or imagine that it could ever be an apolitical endeavor. For Black people, many of the tools and technologies used by our ancestors to heal have been taken or suppressed. And the extent of the traumas we have experienced has been constant and collective, overwhelming our efforts and our resources to address. In many ways, the moment in which we find ourselves is calling for each and all of us to acknowledge and address the existence of Black pain and trauma, finally and with consequence. Each death and each riot activates another memory of another life lost without justice or reason. This is how trauma unhealed haunts and accumulates, reemerging and reanimating the body. It does not disappear. The study of trauma has itself been a way to name human pain that lingers and lives on after rupture, especially in the individual, but increasingly also in the collective. We understand more now about how trauma winds and warps, inhabiting bodies, permeating relationships, and shaping lineages. This country has made a practice of denying the existence of trauma in Black bodies and communities, and also denying its own role ultimately in traumatizing us. We've also denied and ignored it. Our pain has not been a consideration that many of us can afford to feel. So we cope and adapt and make private rituals to honor who has been lost and what of us is lost in their leaving. Denial, though, is always a temporary fix. Each experience is still waiting to be felt, honored, and understood. Waiting is the undeniable impulse the body has toward healing. Healing this generational trauma requires an end to what continues to traumatize us. Police violence, the violence of generational and systemic poverty. It also requires our commitment to the feeling, to the ritual, to the process that will make us anew. On the other side of healing is not a return to what has been, but instead renewed purpose, deeper relationships, and dignity for the collective. Like many others, I came to political work with an unspoken and unconscious motivation to create and experience belonging. I had trained as a therapist and somatics practitioner and spent some years counseling in my community before I came into Black Lives Matter Global Network as the Healing Justice Director, and then later as a politicized somatics teacher. In everything I've done, I've wanted to create spaces where poor people, queer and trans people, Black and brown people, and formerly incarcerated people could heal without being re-traumatized in the process. I had been in too many therapeutic rooms myself that were unsafe, where I had to keep things hidden so as not to be pathologized or blamed, in the way that it is our habit to blame bodies like mine. I wanted a space, however small, for my community to look across the room and not have to hide. I'd been working to create a world that would know how to embrace a child like me, one that would make room for my family to heal. It hasn't always been as clear to me how personal it was, how much of my work was a working through of my own pain. But healing our lineages is also healing our lives. That we parse healing and politics apart is some of what plagues us. To understand uprisings or to understand protests, you have to understand emotional repression. You have to understand that there are feelings that we have not allowed. Rage forms when grief has not been allowed or honored. What I have experienced in the streets is the convergence and expression of grief that spans generations. Grief that has been silenced and unacknowledged but lives on in us. This is also, for so many of us, the practice of healing shame, of moving beyond the frame of respectability that we have been told keeps us safe, but doesn't. What are our politics, if not the method through which we create and distribute wellness with what we have? What is culture, if not our practices of resilience? I started my healing journey in my mid-20s. I'm not sure how I found my way there. I hadn't known anyone who'd even done therapy outside of forced institutionalization. But I knew that I couldn't sort out alone the things that I was trying to sort out. I needed to feel that I could be upset with my family, be hurt. I needed to honor the truth of what I experienced while processing the magnitude of the systemic impact of trauma on my family, how long and for how many years things had tried to break us apart. The force of history landed on my family, on each of us, in our relationships, and the constant nature of it didn't leave room for healing. I remember working years ago with a somatics practitioner, addressing the stories and traumas that live in my body. We had found a contraction, a place in my chest that was almost constantly seized up, protecting me, I discovered, from revealing myself. I came up against the fear that I wouldn't know myself if I let this tension go. I wasn't sure I would trust the person who would come tumbling out, and I wasn't sure, most of all, that I could ensure their belonging. Being myself had for so long seemed a dangerous thing. As soon as I felt it, something in me knew that the contraction ultimately wasn't me. I was the person who was there before the oppression, before the trauma, and before the shame tried to dictate who I am. Healing brought me into a face-to-face confrontation with belonging, with the strategies I had developed to hide, the stories I told about not needing anyone that made the hiding easier. Healing had me admit that it was closeness I wanted, love and relationship and family who didn't ask me to hide. Healing trauma in individuals has never been an easy task. In doing it, we are in fact moving to the body's edge and through the waves of memory and impulses designed to protect our lives. We are revisiting the compromises the body has made to safety, belonging, or dignity in order to survive. And we are finding another path internally where these can be restored, bringing us back into connection, feeling, and community. Black trauma is a concentration of generations of these experiences, experiences that overwhelm not only the individual, but the community, enforced and enacted through policies that have displaced us and criminalized our cultural practices that help us heal. It is also the trauma of systematic denial of resources or stability needed to address the pain and aftershocks of massive collective trauma and daily assaults and indignities. We have survived through a persistent commitment to life, by filling simple lives with big love and a commitment to justice. And the truth of the matter is that the need for healing does not disappear because we have found a way to survive. This work of healing waits for us in moments of stillness or intimacy, in the persistence of doubt or shame, in our struggles to find or sustain stories of meaning or risk living into our purpose. The dissonances we can feel are all the breaks we survived, waiting to be unraveled through feeling, waiting ultimately to free us and our lineage. Our pain aversion makes this question of healing challenging to approach. It is one of the central motivators in American culture to win our way to a pain-free existence. This does not mean that we do not experience pain. All of us do. But it means that we hide it, we deny it, and we transfer it as custom. It means that we shape the world to outsource suffering, that we create structures to concentrate this pain and mythologies of superiority to justify it. These are the mechanics of oppression. It is the organization and distribution of trauma across a society. Those with more power can choose more of their pain. But pain serves a role in a life. When experienced at a digestible rate, when our belonging and safety are not at risk, it can develop us. It can sturdy our sense of ourselves and open up the capacity for empathy. It can remind us that much of what there is to feel can be felt in our bodies or with support from our relations. And yet, pain disproportionately felt, without space for respite or relief, without accountability or acknowledgement, creates a thing that festers. Healing Black trauma is one of the most worthwhile endeavors we all can undertake. It is one that calls for the remaking of all social relations and an examination of our structures and the principles on which they are built. How has denying Black pain narrowed all of our lives? Where have we gone numb to our trauma, imagining that it is too big to face? My work of healing is about recovering Black lifespan, which is whittled away by the body's constant stress. This is the work of recovering Black possibility, creativity, and futures. This can happen in individual healing and therapy. That is some of how I've come to face my own secrets. It is also the work of something bigger: culture, ritual, spaces we create together, our commitment to caring for each and all of us. We can imagine that the purpose of healing is to restore Black people to a mythic past or propel us into a whitewashed version of the future. I don't think healing follows directions. The truth is that I don't know what we become when we heal. None of us does. That is the wisdom of the process. I know that when I opened up to myself, I became more of me. I became curious and porous. I cried more and argued less. I knew where my fight belonged and where it didn't. I knew where I belonged, and I insisted on remaining. In healing, we become more of ourselves. We move away from controlling our expressions, insisting on who we will be, gatekeeping to manage our insecurities, and we discover who we are after all this time, after all these breaks, with all this joy. I am proposing a process, not a destination, a necessary process for us to become, a process that will fundamentally reshape us and our relationships, and will have to, by its very magnitude, reshape the world.
Prentice Hemphill is an embodiment teacher and founder of the Embodiment Institute, TEI, making connections between healing and our most inspiring visions for social change. Before TEI, Prentice was the Healing Justice Director at Black Lives Matter Global Network. They now host the podcast, Finding Our Way.
Love lifted me. Subverting shame narratives and legitimizing vulnerability as a mechanism for healing women in the Black church. Written and read by Tracy Michelle Lewis Jiggets. The women were beautiful. Their eyes, tinted the whitish blue of burgeoning cataracts, were simultaneously dark and mysterious, hinting at stories they'd never actually tell. Their rich, smooth, brown skin belied their 7, 8, or 9 decades of living. I remember watching them with the kind of curiosity only a child could have. I wanted to know the motivation for their clasping of hands in worship or raising them high in praise. Why did an avalanche of tears escape down the sides of their cheeks? Why did their mouths move in silent prayers? And when sound finally found air, why was the melody released into the atmosphere heavy with longing? A longing I now identify as unattainable liberty. Love lifted me. Love lifted me. When nothing else could help, love lifted me. The elder women of the Black Baptist and Pentecostal churches I grew up in, as in most Black churches, were too often the secret keepers. They knew where the bodies were buried. But by being vaults, they often unwittingly became the arbiters of shame. They invested in a theology rooted in patriarchy from the pulpit. They wielded their power as elders to ensure that younger women towed the line of Christian decency. These same women would throw scarves over the legs of women and girls in skirts deemed too short. Don't go tempting the men, child. Don't be one of those fast girls. These same women would loud whisper about the single mother with 4 babies and her lack of self-control, or the young girl who talked too much, who was too smart for her own good. All this, despite the fact that many of them never spent a Saturday night in a cold bed. And as far as being too smart or talking too much, they practically ran the church as well as any corporation. This duality seems to suggest that the shame divvied out by these mothers was never about any particular act, but the exposure of those acts. Never let the right hand know what the left hand is doing, baby. They bought into the narrative that women should appear silent and submissive despite their actual reality of being very vocal and less than deferential. They too often tried to harness the audacity of women and girls who resisted those lies. Men are the head, but we are the neck, and we turn the head any way we want without it realizing it's being turned. For these Black church women, standing bold in their truth and being freely vulnerable was the purview of rich white women who had the privilege of both fearlessness and tears. In addition to the tamping down of our intelligence and sexuality, these women were not supposed to cry about any of it. To deal, we were only supposed to sneak sips of cognac from the flasks held in our bosoms. Or maybe take an extra one of those white pills with the number 10 on the back. Or stuff our faces with the 3-piece dark chicken on white bread with extra hot sauce. We were supposed to do whatever it took to silence that part of ourselves that wanted both Jesus and liberty. There was no room for mourning the station in life we'd accepted. Any emotional expression of our pain was a sign of weakness or rebellion. So we saved our tears for high worship because, at least then, we knew God could bottle them up. This contradiction, dare I say, hypocrisy, reveals how shame has infiltrated the Black church, but still doesn't account for the reality of the Black experience as an intersection. It's unreasonable to explore a larger conversation about what it means to deal with shame in a religious and specifically Christian context without unpacking the intersecting influence of race and gender issues. Growing up a Black church girl. Many Black girls who grew up in the church learned how to perform our worthiness early on. We watched the mothers of the church in the basement kitchen putting together after-service chicken dinners and basking in all the praise for their mac and cheese. We watched Sister So-and-so sing The Walls Down and get the immediate gratification of people passing out in the aisles and crying out to God in a kind of orgasmic exaltation, all because she let the Lord use her. I learned that knowing all the answers in Sunday school Bible trivia garnered me, "That Tracy is so smart," or, "Oh, she's gonna be somebody someday." Those words were my salvation, probably more so than Jesus was, if I'm honest. And by themselves, the words weren't the problem. We should praise our children and reward them for good deeds and behavior. But the unintended consequence, what lay just underneath the words, was the things never said when I was quiet and truly being myself. What does one do when the shame is wrapped in love? When telling a girl to keep quiet because that's just the way these men are is a mode of survival because little Black girls who are hurt and in pain just aren't as valued in this world as little white girls? There is a thread of protection that lines the shame of those church mothers, a protection of themselves and their own minds, so they don't have to waste time they don't have reconciling their whole belief systems. Protection for their baby girls, who will likely enter a world not that much different from the one they've known. The church has created a space where Black women have been able to adapt to our diminishment in a way that feels like there is some reward on the back end for doing so. The more we suffer, the more crowns in heaven and whatnot. And the sad part is, some of us have so internalized such a skewed and distorted version of our faith tradition that we perpetuate this kind of emotional and spiritual violence on other women, to the point where men no longer have to be the enactors. These notions of not being entitled to protection are real for Black women. Such was the reality for enslaved African women, and to some extent, it is still a reality for Black women today. Missing from so much of the scholarship on shame is how the reality of systemic oppression affects a Black woman's ability to be safely vulnerable on a much larger scale than just our personal relationships. We can believe in our inherent worth and value all we want, but moving through a world where our very survival often depends on an acceptance of dehumanization makes healing from trauma complicated. We are swimming in a cesspool of shame, breathing in our own contempt, to the extent that many of us believe that the only way to truly live is to grow steely-hearted gills and adapt. My particular story is sadly one of millions. A Black girl child molested in the dawn of her adolescence, sent away to keep the family together, immersed in a faith tradition that held no space, no room for my story, and thrived on the silence and complicity of its members. Confusion settling in my soul and driving every relationship I'd ever have for the next 40 years, I would inevitably find myself entering middle age, desperately battling the war of anxiety and PTSD that had freely waged against my mind and body for nearly all of my life. Determined to climb out of the muck of a shame narrative that should have never been mine in order to heal. Realizing that deconstructing my faith was the only way to do that and maintain any semblance of spirituality. Doing that healing work required therapy, and it was in therapy, EMDR specifically, where I encountered a visceral response to ambiguity. I was more than a control freak. The need for certainty had defined every area of my life and hindered my ability to move forward in areas that appeared too gray for my liking. Shame and certainty. Church folks' unwillingness to surrender our certitude often becomes a driver for the shaming that happens in the church. We have to be right about the tenets of our faith, about the way God shows up, about the rules and regulations we wield to keep the flock in line. Because what does it mean to not know for sure? Can we still believe if we lean into the mystery of God and accept that maybe there is more than one answer, more than one interpretation, more than one way to embrace faith? Jesus did not shame or shun the woman with the alabaster box who believed she needed to wash his feet with her tears and hair in front of a community of mostly men who tried to debase and degrade her. See Luke 7. Jesus did not shame the Samaritan woman who was living with a man she hadn't quite yet made husband number 6. See John 4. He called out her truth, yes, in the midst of a dialogue with her, something that happens often on our spiritual journeys. But there's no indication that he made her feel unworthy in his presence, despite the fact that the cultural context said neither a man nor a rabbi should be seen speaking to a woman, much less a Samaritan. A long way from the teaching of Jesus, the Christian church too often uses shame as a tool for control and manipulation. But even when we think it's working, it's not. In fact, what's actually happening is that folks who have been shamed by the church have become disenchanted with the faith. What should be safe and holy communities only look like rigid and loveless institutions. American evangelical churches in particular cling to law and government as tightly as their interpretations of the Bible, but don't seem to realize that the Jesus they claim as Savior would have likely broken those laws in order to extend love, peace, and wholeness to those identified as the least of these, the marginalized. That kind of restoration lives at the core of the salvific work of Christ. But we miss all that, and in turn, miss the opportunity to be agents of the Spirit's healing, because we are too deeply invested in certainty as a marker of our faith. Ironic, since by definition, faith requires a relinquishing of certainty. I'm not sure that we can avoid personal experience shaping how we think about God. If we believe that historical and cultural context matter, then it makes sense that those events don't happen in a vacuum. They happen to people and show up as personal experiences. And it's very important, even good, as long as we are conscious that it's our personal experiences shaping our theology, as long as we are not calling that influence absolute truth. My experience as a little brown girl growing up in the church in Kentucky very much informs my perspective of God, even when I wish it didn't. But the critical piece here is that I'm aware that it does. And that awareness means I can check myself when I make certain assumptions about people that are rooted in my experience and not necessarily in anything God has done or is doing. Beliefs aren't ever objective, and I don't think they need to be. I don't think we should want them to be. Thinking in such rigid and stagnant ways keeps you locked into this desperate need for certainty. And if you are so certain about everything, then even God won't be able to tell you any different about what you believe. Your certainty becomes an idol in the face of a God who never changes, but is ever moving. The need to feel certain in our faith derives from a real and honest place for Black folks. The church promises certainty with its proclamations and rules. The perceived upside to these certainties includes having clear markers for how to live in a world that has different rules for Black people. For instance, an emphasis on not having premarital sex, as problematic as that is, might prevent a single motherhood that is shunned by the larger society when those mothers are Black. If children and teens are forced to attend church 3 times a week, then those are 3 days parents don't have to wonder what's going on with their children out there. But the downside, the part of this alleged certainty that does the most harm to Black women, is that it has a tendency to wield shame as a mechanism for keeping us in those boxes, even when we choose not to be. We find our safety there, and anything that disrupts that box is ousted like a demon or called one directly. The shift that needs to happen is one that aligns with the gospel the most. Embracing mystery leaves room for our own mysterious emotional responses and allows love to fill us up in ways that our certain faith never could. As Brené Brown wrote in her book, The Gifts of Imperfection, faith is a place of mystery where we find the courage to believe in what we cannot see and the strength to let go of our fear of uncertainty. This is why the language of certainty, binaries like do this and go to hell, don't do that and go to heaven, are so problematic. Not a single major figure in the Bible took the straight and narrow path. Most took the long, arduous way because, from God's perspective, that was the best route for building the character and confidence necessary to sustain the destiny. That said, I do not think God is terribly interested in blocking or stealing our human agency. Only humans do that to other humans. And Black women in the church have been regular recipients of such thievery. A misguided theology of suffering. The shame narratives that define too many of our experiences haven't come out of nowhere. They are deeply rooted in a westernized, white supremacy-laced theology unknowingly embraced by the Black church. In addition, patriarchy has been so threaded in our interpretations of Scripture that the glorious liberation that Jesus offered all of us, and women especially, is buried under the religious infrastructures many men need to exist in order to maintain a power they perceive as their divine right. Melissa Harris Perry nails this point in her book, Sister Citizen: Shame, Stereotypes, and Black Women in America. The disobedience of Eve in the Genesis story has been used to justify women's inequality and suffering in many Christian traditions. Thus, what is understood as women's complicity with evil leads much traditional theological reflection on suffering to offer the consequent admonition to grin and bear it because such is the deserved place of women. Similarly, when Jesus is seen as a divine co-sufferer, the potentially liberating narratives of Jesus as a revolutionary leader who takes the side of the poor and dispossessed can be ignored in favor of religious beliefs more interested in Jesus as a stoic victim. Christ's suffering is inverted and used to justify women's continued suffering in systems of injustice by framing it as redemptive. The glorification of suffering in the faith generally provides credence for the suffering that Black folks face in the world as a result of oppression. We grab on to the former because it helps the latter all make sense. And yet, the bulk of that suffering falls on the women, who really are the engines of any Black church, from Birmingham to Chicago, Philly to Oakland. Racism drives us toward the suffering narrative, and patriarchy sustains its negative impact on women. As a result, too many of us choose the theology of we must suffer versus we will suffer. While will speaks to inevitability, a global human truth, the must implies that there is something inherent in us that makes us easy collateral damage for the male ego. Love will lift us. But there are some of us who want more and who believe our Creator wants more for us. We are not going to swim in the crap or contort and disfigure ourselves in order to adapt to a world that doesn't see our imago Dei. We are jumping out of the bowl and into our freedom, as frightening and uncertain as that space above feels. When I think about potential solutions, ways to subvert the shame narratives, I can't help but return to those hymn-singing elders of my youth. The typical perspective on transgenerational healing is that the future generations must heal in the stead of our mothers and grandmothers. I agree with this and have watched it play out over and over again. But I also think we'll see a real shift when Nana feels like she can get free first. I'm reminded of my mother who constantly says, "I'm too old for therapy," or "that stuff is for y'all young folks." What if she knew that it was never too late to release the shame that's held her hostage for all these years? A free Nana means all of us can heal no matter what or when. When Nana gets free, then Mama and baby girl can access freedom at any time also. Nana's liberation might create a model for safety and not just survival. What does this look like in the church context? Well, instead of a stern, "cover yourself," Nana gets to chuckle or laugh with that young woman in the short dress about the time she spilled ketchup on her yellow micro mini in the 1970s. In their laughter and in her acceptance, intimacy